Blog Talk Radio.
And never things are changing for the worse. See, what?
Guess who's back? Back again. Guess who's back? Tell your friends. I had to borrow that from the immortal poet Eminem. Hello, everybody. This is the first live episode for 2020 of the Ankeneer Experience. I'm your host. Back again. I want to apologize for being away from you guys for so long. I had technical difficulties. I'll tell you about in just a second. But I'm back. And I don't plan on going nowhere. I think I got everything situated, so we're good to go. I just want to apologize for being away for too long, 4 months. If I was gone, we had a whole bunch of stuff going on between the time I had difficulties and the time I'm back today. So it's been one crazy up and down ride, but I'm back. Glad to be back. Not nervous, I've been doing this too long. I can do this in my sleep. I'm glad to be back, though. Got everything situated, so I am good to go. Before we begin, as you well know, we've got this virus going around, killing people, making people sick. Some people seem to think that this was a hoax. Matter of fact, we're going to talk about this next week, give you the facts in the midst about the coronavirus, so that's going to be next week's topic. Just want to let you know about that ahead of time. I've been working on that already. Want to give a shout-out to all the essential personnel, people that are still working through all this. I'm one of them. Give a shout-out to the people working in grocery stores, which my daughter works in a grocery store. She's going to work every day. Shout-outs to truck drivers. Shout-outs to people in the medical field, especially them, because they are catching it. And I've worked in 3 hospitals, and I can imagine how crazy it is with all this stuff going on. It is straight up crazy. So shouts out to all of them. Matter of fact, I've got to go into work tonight because I am essential. There are certain things I got to do just in case, we go on lockdown. I have to show ID and all this other kind of stuff. But State of North Carolina has not been put on lockdown yet. I got a feeling that will happen. I got a feeling that is coming. The crazy thing about this is that my job, we kind of saw this coming. I've got a technical job where, we monitor stuff all around the world. We've got maps and all this other kind of stuff and other equipment, and we kind of saw this coming. Matter of fact, I've got 2 security jobs. I can only work one. The other one was affected. They've been shut down because of the virus. So it's affecting a whole bunch of people. I think eventually we'll get through this, but it's gonna take some time. So if you're been ordered to stay home, you're pretty much on lockdown, and you're listening tonight. Thank you for listening. At least this gives you a little bit of something else to do besides, I guess, watch TV all day. Because I know if I was home, I'd find something to do too. But thank you for listening. Call in number as usual, 563-999-3682. And we're gonna talk about something. Well, I tell you, let me tell you the story about what happened to before we get into the topic. Okay, what happened was the last show I did was 2019 was about Christmas. Did that show, and I was going to either do, I had planned on talking about impeachment because that was going on at the time, or do a year-end music show. So after I finished the last show, I was planning on doing all that. And my laptop decided that it didn't want to work. The part where you see everything, the monitor, decided that it wanted to quit. So I would turn the laptop off like I always did, and I turned it back on, so I hit the button, and you could hear the fan spinning, but you couldn't see anything. So, start, stop, I pretty much did everything I could to get that stupid thing to run. It would not run. So it put the show in jeopardy. I couldn't figure it out, what was going on. It kind of threw me for a loop, so I didn't have time to go buy another one. So I figured, okay, I'll just miss that show, and I'll come back the following week, and I'll pick up. Well, in between all of that, I had other things going on. I moved from the place I was at then to where I'm at now because I needed the space and other things in life that it had. So the laptop was down. I needed to get another one. I was going to go get another one. I was comparing prices, looking around, trying to think I had to order one offline or whatever. So I'm looking around. So a friend of mine at work, I work in Raleigh. I live in Fayetteville, but I work in Raleigh. And they've got computer stores. And there's one particular computer store that they take laptops and things like that, and they revamp it. So he was telling me about, I had never been there before, so he was telling me about the place. He had gone there and he bought a laptop. And he wasn't planning on buying a laptop, but he bought a laptop. And he was like, well, I got an extra laptop. I said, I don't know what I bought it for. I said, well, I need a laptop. If you want to sell it, I'll buy it from you. Cool. So I bought it from him. So I was going to take the old laptop and have that information transferred to the new laptop because I want my music, I want my pictures, I got my grandkids' pictures, I got all kinds of stuff on there, information, documents, all that kind of stuff. So I was going to transfer that stuff from the old computer, old laptop to the new. Even found a place in town that was going to do it for me. So moving day came. I was moving. Took me a couple of days to move, but on the last move, I got everything out except for my desk and my laptop and some other electronic equipment. So I'm putting stuff in the car. I'm getting, doing the move. And the little voice in my head said, turn the laptop on. And so as usual, I cussed the voice out. I'm like, this thing don't work. Said, cut it on anyway. So I turned it on, hit the button, turned it on. Walked out of the room because I was putting stuff in the car. Turned around and came back. The monitor part was on. So I did a Scooby-Doo. Like, whoop, whoop. Turned my head, came back, and like, wait a minute. So I turned it off again just to make sure that it was working. Turned it off again, turned it back on, and it worked. So as soon as I saw that, I said, well, let me go down and get a flash drive so I can save everything off of that one and put it onto the new one. And I did. The thing works now. Matter of fact, I am coming to you live from the new laptop, sitting on the little bench I have here. The old one is working. So I have no idea what caused all that. So I'm coming to you live from the new one, and it seems to be working just fine. I had all my pictures on the drive, and I suggest that if you have valuable stuff like that, go ahead and get your thumb drive or two or whatever, just to make sure that you don't run into the situation I ran into, which sucked. So I'm up and running now, so we're good to go. Like I said, next week we're going to be talking about the coronavirus. And tonight I may have a special guest call in, so we're leaving that open just in case. But if you want to call, 563-999-3682, or you can just sit back and listen, which is fine, because I'll be off the air at about 8:30, because I have to go to work tonight. I am essential. So, I just want to let you know that. So we'll be off about 8:30-ish. Which is fine. But what I want to talk to you tonight about was we're going to talk about the housing situation in this country. And it is not good for some people, especially black people. And the reason I want to talk about this tonight, because I work in Raleigh. I used to live in Raleigh. Lived in Raleigh for the Raleigh area for over 20 years. And I work downtown Raleigh, and Raleigh is becoming gentrified, even though they don't want to talk about it. But that's the last thing we want to talk about now is gentrification, along with everything else. But Raleigh is becoming gentrified. And what I mean by that is They are buying up parts of the city that have a lot of black folk living there, and they're putting in really expensive houses in these parts of towns that, you know, unless you got big bucks, you can afford. I work in downtown Raleigh, and across from the building I work at, there is an apartment building. And they've got a couple of apartments. I'm not sure how many stories it is, but, you know, we park in the parking deck. We take the elevator downstairs to the first floor. And we can, as we stand waiting for the elevator, we can just look across the street and look, and they've got an apartment over there that's empty, and they leave the lights on all the time. So you can look right in that apartment and see, you know, it's not furnished, it's an empty apartment. So I got online to see how much they rent that apartment for. I know I couldn't afford it, but I was thinking it'd be so cool to, you know, to work across the street from where you live. You know, because I work third shift, and my shift is 12 to 8. You know, I wouldn't walk out of my apartment until, 11:58, and would still be at work on time. But I looked it up, and I hadn't looked up in a while, but I looked it up just to, you know, for shits and giggles. That apartment rents for like $1,200 a month, and I think it's a three-bedroom apartment or something like that. See, it's between $1,200 and $1,400 a month as a house payment, maybe even two house payments. And I'm sure if you want to rent that joint, you have to come up with the rent and last month's rent, too, and probably deposit, all that kind of stuff, which is nuts. Crazy, just crazy, crazy. So we're going to talk about that tonight, and I made a list of some cities in the country, and I'm going to tell you the housing values trying to live there and the rents, the average rents there. Because what is becoming apparent is that a lot of people cannot afford to live in some of these cities. And the reason why I had to leave Raleigh is because the rents just got to be too ridiculous. So I commute for about an hour, going and coming, which is fine. I mean, I'm used to it now. That bothers me. But a lot of people are having to do that because, you know, who wants to work and then give up most of what you earn in rent, not counting all the other bills that you usually have, you know, car and insurance and food and all that other kind of stuff. And I think a lot of these rents are getting really ridiculous. But unfortunately, minorities in this country, especially black people, have been discriminated in housing, and the government had a lot to do with it. And I kind of talked about a few of these things on different shows, and we're going to talk about this. We're going to talk about the term redlining, what that means. Some people may not know what that means. But basically, what redlining is, back in the day, and I've got clips to play, and they'll explain this better than I will. But what was happening is, you know, white folk would go into a real estate office, and they said, you know, they want to buy a house. And so the realtor would usually show them a map, and everything was color-coded. Green was good, yellow was so-so, and red was bad. So anything in the red area, you did not want to get anything in that area. Green was good. Green was usually going to be a suburb. Yellow was so-so. And speaking of Eminem, in Detroit, the 8 Mile section, if I'm not mistaken, that section is blocked off by a fence. On one side is good, the other side is bad, which is pretty banged up, if you ask me, but, you know. So we're going to talk about these issues, and I'm going to read you the guesstimates, whatever. And, you know, somebody's going to come up with something to solve these problems because people need somewhere to stay. You know, nobody, you know, wants to live on the street. But they've got to do something with these prices. But, you know, I guess if you can afford them, hey, you can afford them. There's a couple of sections in Raleigh and Cary, going toward Durham, that, you know, million-dollar houses. And a lot of these houses, you know, we have a Bears, Raleigh has a hockey team. So a lot of those players have houses in that area. And those are, some of those houses are million-dollar houses. You know, you can look at them. You know, I used to, you know, like driving around looking at that. I don't even do that anymore because what's the use of getting mad about something you can't afford? So I don't do it anymore. So, so the first clip we're going to play explains why cities are still segregated. And you would think that we would have gotten over that. I mean, it is 2020. We would have gotten over something like that, but we still, in this country, still practice segregation. And why is that? So we're going to play this clip. And it'll explain to you what's going on.
You know what's so sad, man? You know what's wild? Martin Luther King stood for nonviolence. Now what's Martin Luther King? A street. And I don't give a fuck where you in America. If you're on Martin Luther King Boulevard, there's some violence going down.
That, of course, is Chris Rock's famous joke about streets named for Martin Luther King Jr., which tend to be in, let's say, distressed areas. And he's not wrong, because if you look at the way housing segregation works in America, you can see how things ended up this way. Once you see it, you won't be able to unsee it. Okay, let's look at MLK Boulevard in Baltimore. I want to show you how to see housing segregation in schools, in health, in family wealth, in policing. But first, an explanatory comma. It's the 1930s in the wake of the Great Depression. FDR is president. He wants to bring economic relief to millions of Americans through a collection of federal programs and projects called the New Deal. One part of that New Deal was the National Housing Act of 1934, which introduced ideas like the 30-year mortgage and low fixed interest rates. So now you have all these lower income people who can afford homes, but how do you make sure they don't default on their new mortgages? Enter the Homeowners Loan Corporation. The HOLC created residential security maps, and these maps, they're where the term redlining comes from. Green meant best area, best people, aka businessmen. Blue meant good people, like white-collar families. Yellow meant a declining area with working-class families. And red meant detrimental influences, hazardous, like foreign-born people, low-class whites, and most significantly, Negroes. Again and again on these HOLC maps, one of the most consistent criteria for redline neighborhoods is the presence of black and brown people. Let's be clear, studies show that people who lived in redlined areas were not necessarily more likely to default on their mortgages, but redlining made it difficult, if not impossible, to buy or refinance. So landlords abandon their properties, city services become unreliable, in most places crime increases, and property values drop. All of these conditions fester for 30 years as white people flee to the brand new suburbs popping up all over the country. Many of those suburbs institute rules called covenants that explicitly forbid selling homes to black people, and all of this was perfectly legal.
Ignition.
Now it's 1968, and MLK is assassinated.
Good evening. The Reverend Dr. Martin Luther King, 39.
Apostle of nonviolence in the civil rights movement, has been shot
to death. Martin Luther King was shot and was killed tonight in Memphis.
In the aftermath, Congress passes the Fair Housing Act of 1968. It's a policy meant to encourage equal housing opportunities regardless of race or religion or national origin, and it offers protections for future homeowners and renters, but it does little to fix the damage already done. Over the next 50 years, the Fair Housing Act is rarely enforced. So you can still see housing segregation and its effects in Baltimore and often along any MLK Boulevard in any U.S. city. Like its effects on wealth. So home ownership is the major way Americans create wealth, right? Well, discrimination in housing is the major reason that black families, up and down the income scale, have a tiny fraction of the family wealth that white families do, even white families with less education and lower incomes. For almost 30 years, 98% of FHA loans were handed out to white borrowers. Not only were black neighborhoods redlined, and not only was the Fair Housing Act selectively enforced, if at all, But it is still today much harder for a black person to get a mortgage or home loan than it is for a white person.
Families are fearful of speaking up about a basic human right that should be afforded to everyone in the world, but definitely in the richest country in the world.
And housing segregation in schools. The primary way that Americans pay for public schools is by paying property taxes. People who live in more valuable homes have better funded local schools, better paid teachers, better school facilities, and more resources. Here's a feedback loop. The better the schools in a neighborhood, the more those homes in that neighborhood are worth. And the higher the property values of those homes, the more money there is for schools, and so on and so on. And housing segregation in health. Because of urban planning that benefited those richer, whiter neighborhoods, people of color are more likely to live near industrial plants that spew toxic fumes. They're more likely to live far away from grocery stores with fresh food and in places where the water isn't drinkable. They're more likely to live in neighborhoods with crumbling infrastructure and in homes with toxic paint.
When you're living with rats, roaches, and things like that, that's deplorable. You cannot have that kind of stuff with children running around in a building, a building that may be full of lead.
And not coincidentally, people of color have higher incidences of certain cancers, asthma, and heart disease. And housing segregation in policing. Housing segregation means we are having vastly different experiences with crime and vastly different experiences with policing. Because our neighborhoods are so segregated, sometimes racial profiling can be camouflaged as spatial profiling, where living in certain areas can make you more likely to be stopped by the police. And it means that people have a lot of unnecessary contact with the criminal justice system just because of where they live.
The problem in our city, the police and the citizens are fighting. They keep targeting my brothers and sisters who don't really have nothing.
And that heavy, aggressive kind of policing that you see in black neighborhoods in particular makes people feel like they can't trust the police. And when people don't trust the police, crimes go unsolved. And people have to find other ways to keep themselves safe. But of course, it's not just Baltimore, because housing segregation and discrimination fundamentally shape the lives of people in nearly every major American city. It really is in everything. To hear more about how race shapes American life.
Okay, let me jump to the next clip. 15-minute clip. This talks about suburbs, and then we'll be back and we'll do a little bit of talking, and then we'll get the next couple of clips. So let's do that. Be right back.
Decades of housing discrimination have helped create an enormous wealth gap between white and black families.
The enduring legacy of redlining, the legal government-sponsored effort to deny mortgages and home ownership opportunities to African Americans and other minorities continues to undermine their quality of life. This violation of basic civil rights continues to negatively impact educational attainment, health outcomes, wealth accumulation, self-esteem, mortality rates, and civic engagement. Home ownership has proved to be both the doorway and gatekeeper to success and well-being in America. It is at the core of today's racial wealth gap.
There's a very powerful myth in this country, and that is that residential segregation in this country is something we call de facto segregation, something that happened by accident. Every textbook that's used in American high schools and middle schools today lies about this history. Talks about how northern cities were de facto segregated without government involvement. They talk about how the Federal Housing Administration did a wonderful job of creating single-family homes in the suburbs for working-class families, without mentioning that the working-class families that created these homes for could only be white.
This began a history of excluding people of color from government housing programs. Intended to lower the cost of mortgages and increase home ownership. Segregated neighborhoods by race using a code system. Outlined minority neighborhoods using the color red. intended to expand the secondary mortgage market by securitizing mortgage loans. Community boards often denied minority veterans mortgages. Many minority vets could not be buried in the same cemetery as whites. It wasn't until 1970 that lending to communities of color began to increase.
The way this manifested itself was through the drawing of maps. Different neighborhoods were underwritten as being riskier or safer, and the principal component that determined riskiness or safety from a lending standpoint was ethnic and racial composition.
It was at that point that the real estate developers began to drop strings around areas. The local banker could choose who would get mortgages, where, so that we could not have gotten a loan out in the suburbs because those were whites only. The concept of a middle-class black only exists in the mind of a middle-class black. Everywhere else in the suburbs, you are that nigger family on the corner of Warren Road and Boulevard Way.
Well, the truth is that we've had in this country generations of affirmative action for whites. And the sad truth of it is that whites don't know that that's happened, or they refuse to accept it, or don't understand the history. And what that leads to is this false kind of narrative that I did it myself. You know, this Horatio Alger individual responsibility narrative.
There were many federal, state, and local policies explicitly racial, designed to create segregation in every metropolitan area in the country, and policies that were so powerful that they still determine the racial boundaries of metropolitan areas today. The Federal Housing Administration began a program to suburbanize the entire white working class population into single family homes.
This is Levittown, Pennsylvania, a new suburban community of 60,000 people with its giant shopping center, winding lanes named for flowers and trees. It is fairly typical of communities all over America where families are pursuing the American dream to give their children a better chance in life. Nearly all are young people. A large proportion are veterans. For many, it is the first house of their own, and it represents a major financial investment. In August 1957, Levittown, Pennsylvania attracted international attention as William Myers Jr. and his family moved into the three-bedroom house. They're very close to the Levittown norm, except in one respect. William Myers Jr. and his family are Negroes in an all-white community.
If more colored are allowed to move in, Levittown is going to go downhill.
The only way that those developers could get the capital to do that was by going to the Federal Housing Administration. In order to get that approval, they had to commit never to sell a home to an African American.
Access to leverage allowed middle-class whites to build wealth.
The white families who bought those homes were able to use their wealth to send children to college, and they used it to bequeath wealth to their children, who could use it as down payments for their own homes.
Restricted covenants ensured that minorities could not buy into white neighborhoods. Properties shall continue to be occupied by the same social and racial classes.
When Karen and I purchased this home that was built in 1948, we found some documents in a closet.
Neither the whole or any part of said tract shall be sold, rented, or leased to any persons or persons not of white or Caucasian race.
Created greatest growth of the middle class in the history of the world. In 1940, 42% of white families owned their own home. In 2000, 71% of white families owned their own home.
So consequently, that those 71%, 72% of white homeowners who own their own home should be thankful to the federal government for providing them this opportunity. What did not happen, or what happened at the same time, was that we, people of color, were discriminated against and were prevented from taking advantage of those opportunities.
The recent housing and foreclosure crisis were a continuation of a form of redlining. Financial institutions practice unrealistic credit scoring and predatory lending. Subprime mortgages grew nearly 250%. In 1998, subprime mortgages made up 9.8% of the mortgage market. By 2006, they made up 23.5% of the market.
And the gap between white homeownership rates and black homeownership rates is 30 percentage points larger than it was back in 1968. In 1968, the typical black family had 1/6 as much wealth as the typical white family. Now it is 1/10. We have gone backwards since the civil rights era.
Latinos lost close to $170 billion worth of equity that they had accumulated in the home that they purchased many, many years before then.
When they come to access products, the choices that they're given are limited. So you're given, instead of conventional loan, you're given a special loans that have higher interest rates or higher fees that again set you up for foreclosure or failure as well.
The scandal of your tenure is your unwillingness to do your job and enforce the laws that reduce housing discrimination.
The housing crisis affected all communities, but disproportionately devastated minority families. Black and Hispanic families lost nearly 20 years of wealth between 2007 and 2013. Minority home ownership is the lowest it's been since 1996.
Redlining discrimination in the Asian American community is live and kicking. And in California, you'll see that Asians had the second highest probability of going to foreclosure, very comparable to Latinos. So Latinos were 1.4, for Asians it was 1.3. And so whether it is in homeownership, rental, small business, foreclosure, across the board, there is redlining.
Between 1934 and 1962, $120 billion in FHA and VA loans were issued. Over that period of time, 98% of the loans went to white families and less than 2% went to African Americans and other minorities. Using the average home price index between 1934 to 2018, those FHA VA loans equates to at least $3 trillion in current real estate value. Assuming that as loans were paid off and excess funds were invested in stocks and other investments, conservatively, another $2 trillion were created. This white subsidy is the major contributor to the current racial wealth gap.
So many white Americans experience this sense of self-esteem, a sense of superiority, if you will, this sense of mastery, that they have created their own destiny in their lives, and they have no acknowledgement of this invisible hand that supported them throughout their lives, and not just them, but there's a legacy of that invisible hand across generations that has translated itself from the original affirmative action to trillions of dollars of a head start ahead of other communities like African Americans, Latinos, Native Americans, others who don't have the same benefit.
Children of homeowners are more likely to graduate from high school, have less childhood behavioral problems, and achieve higher college graduation rates.
In segregated housing and in neighborhoods that are thereby segregated that tend to be low-income neighborhoods, there is the greater likelihood that the youngsters will be involved in gangs or will be recruited to be in gangs.
I noticed an absence of hope, an absence of light. These kids were barraged with a message every single day of their lives that they weren't valued, that they didn't matter. And they internalized that. and that caused frustration and anger and eventually despair and a loss of hope.
There's now very good science that shows that the sense of not belonging, the sense of lacking self-esteem, raises cortisol levels in your blood. And cortisol is good for you when you're in an extremely stressful situation, but when you're constantly bathed in cortisol because you're constantly feeling these stressors of being marginalized and being told that you're less worthy, less valuable, and being in constant state of really fear and anxiety, it changes your physiology completely. It makes you more prone to cardiovascular disease. It makes you more prone to diabetes. It makes changes in your brain, which actually makes it more difficult to engage in what we call executive function.
This kind of chronic stress, which is driven by the policies that we have created, is as lethal as any knife or any gun.
Suppose discrimination did end today. How many generations would it take to get to rough equality in wealth across races? Her answer is 7 generations, more than 200 years.
And so when white Americans hear about affirmative action for blacks or for Latinos, they're outraged. They think, I've done this by myself. Why can't these people? There's something wrong with these people.
The same programs that were provided to white Americans that enabled them to accumulate this wealth through home ownership, those same opportunities have to be provided to us.
Imagine where minority families would be today if their grandparents had the same access to wealth through home ownership that white families had. What would the wealth gap be between white and minority families if minorities had the same access to wealth through home ownership? Would there be a gap?
Okay, and we've got a phone call. I'm going to grab it right quick, but before we do, I'm going to tell you my story. I was a victim of a subprime loan. First 2 years of that loan, payments were paid on time. Everything was lovely. It was the same amount for about 2 years. Then all of a sudden, that third year, they went up. And when you're on a budget and you've got everything lined up like you want it and everything's cool, and you're still making about the same amount of money, everything is all right until they decide they want to jack up the mortgage rate. Matter of fact, they jacked the mortgage rate up about almost $400 out of the blue. You know, they sold my mortgage to 5 different mortgage companies. And you may have heard of one, Countrywide, which was found out later to be one of the crookedest places, companies that, you know. So my mortgage was sold to 5 different companies. My payments went up to almost over $400 a month. And you're talking about turning your world upside down when you have a wife and you've got kids and a dog and jobs and kids are going to school and you trying to make it, and then all of a sudden that happens to you. And then you have to tell the kid that we have to move because of this. That part of my life really is really hard. It sucked big time. But we got through it. And I'm sure there are millions of other people that had to go through the same stuff I had to go through. So, you know, when people, you know, tell that lie or whatever, you know, I've got all this land in my family, and I say to them, well, what tribe did you guys steal it from? And, you know, don't sit here and pretend that, you know, y'all got this by, you know, the sweat on your brow. You had help. You know, when people of color, we don't get that kind of help. They get it, and then it's like, you know, I did this on my own. No, you did. You had help. Just admit to it, but, you know, that's another story altogether. All right, let's go to this phone call before we get to the next couple of clips, and then I'll read you my list. It's pretty interesting. Here we go. Hey, what's going on?
Hey, Anthony, what's happening?
What's happening? I'm back.
That's good. How's the family?
Everybody's good. Everybody's good. Nobody's been affected. Nobody's been sick from this mess. I'm still working. Everybody's good so far. And hopefully they'll stay that way.
Yeah. Well, you know, I was listening to that piece. I can find a lot of fault with that. And I guess you say, I guess you can. But on a square business side, I can. And why is these, let me ask you a question. Why is these undocumented immigrants able to buy homes using their I-10 number? And blacks continue to complain about, black citizens complain about being treated unfair when it comes to getting home mortgages.
Well, I get, well, I don't, that'll be something I'll have to look up and see if I can find some information on, but
get his articles on
it. Answer to that, it's a simple, I guess simple answer to that would be discrimination, because, you know, I can drive around town. Well, let's see, I'll use Raleigh as an example. Raleigh's bigger than where I'm at now, but there are, matter of fact, I went by one other night, the shopping centers, or whatever you want to call them, you know, full of Mexican, you know, restaurants, stores, grocery stores, shops, you know, hair salons, all that kind of stuff. You know, pretty mm-hmm. nice side of town. And then when you go to the black side of town, you know, they've got sections like that, but they don't have as many of them, and they're not as nice as some of these other ones are. I'll have to research that and see if I get some information on that.
You got a pencil and paper?
Yeah.
I'm going to tell you what to Google.
Okay.
You put down undocumented immigrants, I-10, it's I-T-I-N, I-T-I-N, which stands for Individual Tax Identification Numbers. It's a number that the IRS gives the immigrants who can't qualify for a Social Security card number because they're not citizens. But Bank of America and Citibank, and they also issue them a credit card. Then they get driver's license. You know, you got states like New York say illegals can have driver's license. Now, let me ask you something. When you moved in that house that you moved in, was it in a different voting district when you moved into it?
I don't think so.
In other words, you had lived in that voting district. You had lived around the corner or something like that.
Wait a minute. Well, no, it wasn't, because it was in a different county too.
Okay,
county.
Now
but,
let
yeah,
me
I
ask you something.
Yeah.
What did you use to verify that you lived in the county? You used your mortgage
Probably
papers,
mortgage,
right?
The mortgage papers. Yeah. Because I get all that stuff changed. Yep.
Okay. Well, once you showed them that, they didn't ask you if you were a citizen. But these illegals and these undocumented use that same paperwork to get registered to vote. And they undocumented. They illegal. And it's supposed to be anywhere from 11 to 30 million of them in the country. I wonder if those was the popular vote that Hillary Clinton got. And I'm kidding. Check it out. Undocumented live their American dream. And they use that I-10 number. But anyway, I don't want to hold up your program. I could comment some more on those other things in some more areas,
okay,
too, because black people get hurt by that, too. You have people moving into the community that really shouldn't be in those communities because they don't have enough income to substantiate that house and what's required to maintain that house. And I can show you, give you a lot of instances, and one is Ferguson. Blacks moved into Ferguson decades ago. probably in the late 60s and the 70s. Whites moved out. Blacks took over those properties and kept them immaculate. Had a good school system. It was called the Ferguson School District. Then they had to combine with Florissant, Ferguson Florissant. Kinloch was Kinloch Berkeley. Berkeley still there. I think Kinloch merged with Berkeley. Kinloch was an old, ancient black town. So the blacks had just blacks moved out of the city into the city of St. Louis, into Ferguson. And you know of the things that went on surrounding Mike Brown. And the rioting and burning and looting started. Now, blacks started moving out of Ferguson. And I'm telling you, when blacks moved from the city into Ferguson, blacks that had been living in Ferguson began to flee. And now you got Ferguson, you got Castle Point, you got Berkeley. Berkeley is where you done had over 30 or 38 girls disappear in the last 20 years. All of them black except for one. Berkeley and parts of Charlotte Hills, those areas are starting to become dilapidated. And blacks are fleeing that has been living there for a long time. And guess what? They are losing money, equity, that would have been built up in their homes if they had left 10 years before that. So, those are things that happen.
Let me play this next clip. This is talking about redlining. I've got two more clips, and then I'm gonna read you this list about these home values and all this, which is pretty interesting. So I've got some information on that. So I'm gonna play this clip and then be right back.
You ever feel like you're just going in circles? So this is Halsley, a still developing subdivision in Midlothian, Virginia. This place won the National Home Builders Award in 2017 for Best Master Planned Community, and there are a ton of cul-de-sacs.
1, 2, 3, 4.
Let's just go to the map, save some time. Cul-de-sacs are everywhere. They're a symbol of suburban sprawl, but they aren't an accident. They're physical evidence of how one federal agency shaped the suburbs in ways that we're still grappling with today. English suburban plans inspired early suburbs in the United States, like Radburn, New Jersey, which offered a unique plan. Founded in 1929, it was designed to be car-friendly, but it introduced a street that served more like an alleyway or service road. It was almost a prototype for the cul-de-sac. Cars traveled and parked in back of houses, not in front. People walked to and from the train via footpaths that were car-free. Though Radburn wasn't totally finished, today you can see the footpaths that still provide a pedestrian network for residents. But out of those ideas, it was Radburn's cul-de-sac, not its footpaths, that spread, thanks to an agency with the power to do it. In 1929, the Great Depression crushed the housing market. The bust dragged on for years.
A decline of 92% from 1928. But due to the stimulation of the National Housing Act, 1935 presents a different picture.
Before 1934, mortgages required anywhere from 30 to 50% down, paid off as quickly as 5 years. The new Federal Housing Administration, or FHA, insured mortgages for lenders, shrinking down payments to 20% and extending the mortgage to the now standard 30 years. All that made home buying affordable and kicked off a housing boom for purchasing and construction.
This tidal wave of new construction is an important contribution to the economic rebuilding of America. Home ownership is the basis of a happy, contented family life.
I know you're probably like, how does any of this connect cul-de-sacs or suburban design? The thing is that the FHA wanted to ensure that all these investments they were making were relatively safe investments. So to do that, they ranked and rated neighborhoods and homes, and then they created guidelines for those ratings. And that is where things get complicated. Some FHA guidelines we'd see today is roughly positive, like minimum property requirements. Think minimum standards for plumbing and foundation of new houses to guarantee they weren't just junk. Mostly good. Except for the asbestos. Lots of asbestos. On the other end of the spectrum, the FHA explicitly endorsed segregation as a measure of housing quality, i.e., segregation equals good neighborhood. This underwriting manual puts it really clearly. If a neighborhood is to retain stability, it is necessary that properties shall continue to be occupied by the same social and racial classes. So these guidelines ran the gamut from mundane to appalling. But developers would be taking a huge risk to ignore the FHA, since these loans sold houses. Somewhere in the middle of the spectrum, the FHA's recommendations also included city planning. They started with car-friendly minimum street widths and then expanded. In bulletins like Planning Profitable Neighborhoods, the FHA laid out ideal suburban plans, which were clearly labeled bad or good. They drew from models like Radburn, but focused on the car and left out the pedestrians. Grid plans were definitively bad. Other plans with curvilinear or winding roads were good. That included cul-de-sacs. This FHA-labeled bad plan shows why curved streets really did make sense sometimes. The dotted lines show topography, like hills. A grid plan would have required a ton of construction to work around the landscape. The good plan, a curvilinear one, reduces construction costs and is just nicer to look at. But these plans also insisted on a car-centered vision of the neighborhood, with cul-de-sacs designed to slow down vehicles and limit through traffic, while also guaranteeing that cars were necessary to get around. This bad plan would have worked well for public transportation and city services, or a walking commute, but developers couldn't risk bad plans. The good plan was the only safe option if they wanted their houses to sell. Plans drafted the bad way were revised to fit the FHA's vision of the good life. That was a combination of financial coercion and a quickly evolving sense of what a suburb should be. Listen, I played kickball in cul-de-sacs. They have a lot of advantages. They really do slow down through traffic. They create a sense of community. They just have a lot of things going for them. And this subdivision here doesn't have much to do with those outmoded FHA guidelines, but it does exist in a culture that those guidelines created. The cul-de-sac, it crowded out a million other good ideas. Ideas that could have had a different vision of the suburbs. Ideas that weren't all about this. Today, some suburbs are changing the plan. There's even a way to make existing cul-de-sacs more walkable. But it's a little strange that so many places are still beholden to the old FHA's vision of the one good life. This is a proposed black subdivision near Atlanta from a 1948 FHA plan. The plan included a planting strip to serve as a visible boundary between white and black neighborhoods. In the same plan, the FHA plotted very elegant curvilinear streets and cul-de-sacs. That's it for this episode about the suburbs. Let's read some comments from the...
Okay, it is 8 o'clock, so I've got about 30 minutes left, so I'm going to go ahead and play this last clip, and then I'm going to read you this list that I have, because it's long, and I'm trying not to rush through this. But this last clip is about gentrification, in case you don't understand how that works. I was going to try to explain it, but I decided not to. If you want to get a very good description of how gentrification works, the next time you watch Boys in the Hood, you'll get to that part toward the end of the movie. That gives you the entire definition of gentrification in a nutshell. A whole lot better than I can explain it. But that's exactly what I think and what other people are thinking. I'm part of a few Facebook page groups since I used to live in Raleigh, I like to keep up with things that are going on in the communities, because I did live on the southeast side of town, which, you know, whenever you tell people that you live in a black neighborhood, the first thing they think of is ghetto and all that crap. No, I did not live in a ghetto. I lived in the part of town I was on was nice. Schools, right downtown from Shaw University, which is a HBCU, churches, parks, whatever it was, you name it, that's what they had. But there is, what I talked to some people on online about, that gentrification is creeping up in Raleigh, and you can see it all over the place. So this is a definition of what gentrification is, and you know how it affects us and all that kind of stuff. And then I'm going to read you the list of home prices and average home prices and all this kind of stuff. And the prices are off the hook. And it's a list I put together about a week and a half ago. So some of these values might have gone up, they might have gone down, but it's just the average price of different cities in the country. I've got, let me see what I've got. I've got LA. I've got what is this? New York. I'm just going through the list now. I've got Raleigh on that list. I've got Washington D.C. I've got Miami. And the last one I have is where I live now, Fayetteville. So I'm going to read you those numbers in just a second. I'll play this last short little clip, and then that should run us up until the end of the show. I'd like to get everything in on time because I am a perfectionist. Now I'm playing, but we'll see. All right, play this. I'll be back.
Gentrification is constantly being talked about. In the past 10 years, the number of Google searches for the word gentrification has more than doubled, and mentions in the news and in literature have gone up. So, people are talking about gentrification, but they often mean different things when they use the term. Gentrification is a process of neighborhood change that includes economic change in a historically disinvested neighborhood by means of real estate investment and new, higher-income residents moving in, as well as demographic change, not only in terms of income level, but also in terms of changes in the education level or racial makeup of residents. Gentrification is complex and needs some explaining. To understand it, there are three key things to consider: the historic conditions, especially policies and practices that made communities susceptible to gentrification, the way that central city disinvestment and investment patterns are taking place today as a result of these conditions, and the ways that gentrification impacts communities. Over the last century, many policies and practices have created racialized patterns of disinvestment in city centers that have left low-income communities of color particularly susceptible to gentrification. From the 1930s through the late 60s, standards set by the federal government and carried out by banks explicitly labeled neighborhoods home to predominantly people of color as risky and unfit for investment. This practice, now known as redlining, meant that people of color were denied access to loans that would enable them to buy or repair homes in their neighborhood. Other housing and transportation policies of the mid-20th century fueled the growth of mostly white suburbs and the exodus of capital from urban centers, in a phenomenon often referred to as white flight. Take the GI Bill as an example. The program guaranteed low-cost mortgage loans for returning World War II soldiers. But discrimination limited the extent to which black veterans were able to purchase homes in the growing suburbs. In fact, the Federal Housing Administration largely required that suburban developers agree to not sell houses to black people in order for the developers to access these guaranteed loans. Left behind in central city neighborhoods, low-income households and communities of color bore the brunt of highway system expansion and urban renewal programs, which resulted in the mass clearance of homes, businesses, and neighborhood institutions, and set the stage for widespread public and private disinvestment in the decades that followed. In more recent history, the foreclosure crisis also contributed to neighborhood-level vulnerability to gentrification. In low-income communities of color, disproportionate levels of subprime lending resulted in mass foreclosure, leaving those neighborhoods vulnerable to investors seeking to purchase and flip homes in bulk. Today, both people and capital are flooding back into these historically disinvested neighborhoods. One reason new people are moving into these neighborhoods is because of their relative affordability. In many U.S. cities, the rental market has gotten increasingly expensive, and even moderate income earners are on the hunt for lower housing costs. This means that in some places, they are looking in historically disinvested communities, often the same neighborhoods previous generations left behind during the days of white flight. These neighborhoods are often characterized by older historic housing stock that appeals to new residents and close proximity to city centers, where jobs, restaurants, and art spaces are increasingly locating. Cities are also investing in revitalizing some of these neighborhoods, for example, with improved transit access and infrastructure, in part to draw in newcomers. On the ground, gentrification may look like real estate speculation, with investors flipping properties for large profits, as well as high-end development, and landlords looking for higher-paying tenants. Increased investment in neighborhood amenities like transit and parks. Changes in land use, for example, from industrial land to restaurants and storefronts. And changes in the character of the neighborhood, as community-run businesses are replaced by businesses catering to new residents' needs. While increased investment in an area can be positive, gentrification is often associated with displacement, which means that, in some of these communities, longtime residents are not able to stay to benefit from new investments in housing, healthy food access, or transit infrastructure. Instead, lower-income families, often families of color, may find themselves facing rent increases, evictions, or other displacement pressures, and left with no other choice but to move to suburban or even exurban areas, far away from their jobs and the businesses and service providers they know. This can mean more time commuting, less time spent at home, and increased isolation, depression, and stress levels. For children, displacement can disrupt educational pathways and generate negative health impacts. Even for long-time residents who are able to stay in newly gentrifying areas, changes in the makeup and character of a neighborhood can lead to a reduced sense of belonging or feeling out of place in one's own home. For example, unique cultural vibrancy can be lost as places of worship see their congregants displaced to faraway cities and towns. In addition, family-run businesses and nonprofit organizations may be forced out as their customer base disperses, or as their commercial rents rise past what they can sustain, affecting the ability of those who stay to access the goods and services they need. There might also be changes in neighborhood norms and policing, for example, an increased police presence in order for new residents to feel safe. On the whole, we cannot ignore that the adverse impacts of gentrification, ranging from individual health effects to the suburbanization of poverty, are only the most recent wave in a pattern of urban restructuring that has been imposed upon and negatively affected low-income and communities of color over generations. Public, private, and nonprofit sector leaders have the opportunity to implement strategies that give longtime residents a chance to benefit from increased investment in their communities and even be part of driving how some of the changes in their neighborhoods take place. In order to invest in communities without displacement, policies, programs, and financing tools are needed to protect renters from formal and informal displacement pressures, facilitate the production of more affordable housing, and preserve and upgrade the existing affordable housing stock. Involving community residents in planning and decision-making about their neighborhoods and region can and should be a key piece of all three of these strategies. Taken together, these strategies can help keep communities together so that everyone can enjoy access to improved schools, better food options, more job opportunities, and safer neighborhoods. Qualities we know make cities and regions healthy and vibrant.
Okay, so we've got a few more minutes left before we get to the end. So let me read you these housing values. These are different sections in the country. Some of them are high, some of them are low, some of them are off the chain. Okay, so we're going to start with Los Angeles. The average price for a house in Los Angeles $723,783. These houses are single family homes, which is, you know, mother, father, two kids. And the rents in the Los Angeles area, the median rent price is $3,500 to rent. That is per month, and that is crazy as hell. But let's go through some of the neighborhoods in Los Angeles. Bel Air, the median price in Bel Air is $3,264,800. Beverly Crest, $2,260,600. Mid City West, $1,516,200. Pico Robertson, $1,202,500. Studio City, $1,188,900. Westwood, $1,137,700. Century City, $1,024,400. Sherman Oaks, $890,000, and Valley Village, $851,200. And the rents average at about $3,500 a month. New York average is $652,728. The median rent is $2,900. Okay, and let's see. Neighborhoods in New York, or boroughs, I'm sorry, the boroughs in New York. Manhattan is $1,322,100. Brooklyn is $718,400. Queens is $517,800. And Staten Island is $481,600. And like I said, the rents are in New York are $2,900 a month. Raleigh. Average house in Raleigh will run you $284,829. The median rent in Raleigh is $1,495. And I think that apartment across the street from where I work runs about, I think between $12,000 and $14,000. It's pretty neighborhoods in Raleigh. Glenwood, $607,300. Wade, $454,400. Five Points, $411,300. Six Forks, $391,700. Central, $239,000, and North Central, $231,700. And I'm familiar with all of these neighborhoods. Matter of fact, we should have put down Briar Creek, which is between Raleigh and Durham. And those are million-dollar houses, and they're still constantly building houses. And you can tell that, because usually when they build them, they'll have signs on the street. And they will say something like houses starting at 200,000, houses starting at 300,000, you know, stuff like that. And like I said, the rents, they are about $1,495. Washington, D.C. Average home price is $636,372. The median rent is $2,700. Neighborhoods in Washington. Bloomingdale, $782,500. Shaw, $740,900. I hope I'm saying this right. Detroit, LED, ROIT, I guess that rhymes with Detroit, New York Park, $736,700. Truxton Circle, $713,500. Logan Circle, $578,800. Judiciary Square, $561,700. Mount Vernon Square, $548,700. Penn Quarter, $485,100. And MoMA, $481,900. And the median rental price is $2,700 a month. So this is Miami. Average price is $366,519. Median rent is $24,450. Neighborhoods in Miami are as follows. Northeast Coconut Road, $637,800. Shenandoah, $406,800. Brickell, $375,800. Downtown Miami, $375,800. Coral Way, $371,200. Alameda West Flagler, $278,200. Radami, I think that's how you say that, $253,000. Little Havana, $152,100. And I can't even say this. Allapattah, A-L-L-A-P-A-T-T-A-H, $148,400. And the average rent is $2,450 a month. And last but not least, where I reside today, Fayetteville, North Carolina, average home price is $121,427. The median rent here is $950. So this is the lowest on the list. Neighborhoods around here, Linden is $185,000. Bun Level is $176,900. Stedman is $143,200. Hope Mills is $141,200. Spring Lake is $140,700. And Wade is $125,900. With $950 the average rent. So, as you can tell by those numbers, I mean, it, you know, depending on what part of the country you live in, depends on, you know, if you have enough money to buy a house or to rent. Now, a lot of people cannot afford to do both. They have to pick one or the other. A lot of people have to, you know, if they're going to rent, they have to have roommates. And that's what I did here before I moved. And that's, you know, that's okay if you like that kind of stuff. The only thing that will get me back to move to Raleigh is I'd have to get a job that pays crazy, pay the crazy amount of money, or I have to get roommates. And, you know, and that can be depending on how you are. I mean, if you like sharing a house with other people, hey, you might can do that. If you're the type of person that, you know, likes to be alone, then maybe, you know, you just have to do what you, you know, have to do. And I'm kind of in between both of those. I mean, I didn't mind having roommates. The roommates I had were cool. We were all quiet. We all did our own thing. We all worked. We went to work. We came home, you know, hung out in our rooms, because that's what all the entertainment was. You're either in your room, in the bathroom, or in the kitchen. You know, we didn't have anything in the living room, so all our entertainment was in our room, so that's where we spent a whole lot of time. And everybody was cool. It was quiet. You know, nobody bothered nobody, you know, if you like that kind of thing, you know. And where I'm at now, I'm by myself. I needed the room for my grandkids when they come to visit. So I'm cool with that. You know, have people, you know, visitors here and there or whatever. So I'm cool with that. So it just depends on what you can afford and what you like. And really the thing is what you can afford. Because you can't afford, then you can't, you know. And actually living here, my rent here is $200 cheaper than when I was in Raleigh. The only, you know, you have pros and cons. The only con, and it, to me it's not a con, the only con some people think would be like, you know, you having to drive an hour to and from work. Well, I mean, it is what it is, but I save that $200 on rent, and I, you know, I've got other bills that if you get on the budget, do what you got to do, you know, should be good to go, depending on, you know, how you set it up. And I'm working two jobs, so, you know, that helps. So, that's going to be the end of this show, because I've got to get ready to head on out and go to said work, because I am essential personnel. But I hope this show tonight, and again, I'm glad to be back. And I hope this show, you know, gave you a little bit of information on, you know, what the housing situation is in the country. I mean, it's just, you know, one of the things that, you know, people, you know, we all got to have somewhere to live. I mean, you know, and unfortunately, I drive by the homeless shelter in Raleigh every day, going to work and leaving work. I drive by there every day, and I see people standing outside, you know, and pretty much, you know, they're everywhere in that, on that side of town, on the south side of town, and they're always, you know, walking. You know, they've got, some have book bags, some have suitcases, and they're all up and down the street. And with this virus going on, you know, I got a feeling that day comes that, you know, they're going to put everybody on lockdown. You know, where are you people going to go? I was over there one day, and I actually saw people sleeping up under a bridge in book bags, I mean, in sleeping bags. And, you know, they sleep in the woods. There's a trail over there, a couple of trails over there, and they sleep in the woods back in those trails. They sleep in the, I saw them up under a bridge. You know, sometimes if they don't make it to the shelter before a certain time, they're sleeping out there on the sidewalk out there by the door. I mean, it's just, you know, it's crazy. So we all need to have somewhere to live. And then at the same time, there's, you know, empty houses everywhere too. So I don't know why somebody didn't, you know, I think another, I've heard in other towns, you know, people are trying to, you know, do something about that situation, but it's just that, you know, I cannot imagine, you know, and I will say that, you know, at one point before, you know, it started getting stuff together, at one point I was technically homeless until I got everything, you know, had to make phone calls, had to do, you know, but eventually got through that situation, so, you know. So I can relate to that, you know. I understand. But I think the difference between me and some of those people is that, you know, I mean, I don't know these people personally, so I don't know. But, you know, there are some people that would rather sleep on the street than do the right thing and try to find a home to live. You know, maybe those people have some kind of issue or whatever. I don't know, so I can't speak on that. But, you know, there was no way I was going to let that situation beat me and then end up on the street and then, nah, can't do that. So I'm going to get ready to put a big bow on this show. We were supposed to have somebody, one of my friends, call in, but I guess he couldn't make it. So I'll have to get up with him and see if he can make it next week. We're going to talk about the coronavirus and all that kind of stuff. And I guarantee you by then the numbers are going to be crazier than they are right now. So, but we're going to talk about that. And, you know, we need information. And in other words, give you the truth on that, not a lot of this crazy stuff that's going around. Matter of fact, I'll tell you this before I go. Where am I? I'll tell you this before I go. Doggone it. This thing is acting stupid. Somebody was trying to tell people that in order to get rid of the coronavirus, you should blow a hair dryer up your nose. And that way you won't get it. You know, people need to stop with that nonsense. People need to stop that nonsense. Hopefully it's still in my arm. Ooh, okay, here we go. That little technical thing. Okay, here we go. So people need to stop with that nonsense. You don't tell people to blow their hairs out. They know we can get rid of a deadly virus. But anyway, all right. So I'm getting ready to end this. We had something like cuckoo all of a sudden. But okay, so I'll be back next week. Same time, same place, 7 a.m. to 8:30 p.m. Oh, my goodness, 7 p.m. to 8:30 p.m. Talking about the coronavirus. So I will see you next week. Peace out.